Welcome to the HJ Talks About Abuse podcast, the podcast where we talk about sexual abuse cases in the hope that it will assist listeners in openly discussing topics which have been ignored for too long. This podcast is brought to you by the abuse team at Hugh James. We are lawyers, so we tend to speak about the legal aspects of abuse cases, but we aren't too shy to speak up about the broader issues faced by survivors of sexual abuse too. We hope that you find it interesting, but more than that, if you are a survivor of sexual abuse, we hope that you find our discussion empowering.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Alan Collins. I'm the partner at Hugh James that heads up the abuse team. And on a very regular basis, we have a podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Sauter, who is an associate professor of criminology at the University of New South Wales. Great privilege, as always, to have you join me on a podcast, Michael. So thank you very much.
Great to be with you, Alan.
Thank you very much. And today we are going to be talking about cover-ups in the context of child sexual abuse and child sexual abuse revelations. And we thought we would discuss this in the wake of the Royal Commission's publication of its report in relation to Cardinal Powell and allegations that he'd covered up child sex abuse. So basically, the scenario is that he was aware of allegations and basically covered up. So we thought we would discuss, against that backdrop, why somebody would want to cover up allegations of child sexual abuse. And I always liken it to hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. So in that context, that's what we're going to discuss. Preliminary thoughts, Michael.
I think what we find when we look at public inquiries like the Royal Commission or the Independent Inquiry, and just more generally, you know, when we look across the recent history of child abuse over the last 50 years or so, is really the institutional tendency towards protecting reputations. That where institutions have been confronted with evidence of child sexual abuse occurring, you know, within their remit, so, you know, staff members, individuals associated with the institution abusing kids, the consistent impulse of institutions has been to essentially conceal the offence in order to protect the reputation of the institution. And this is just a very consistent pattern across time and across the globe.
So what is it that makes them think that we are protecting the institution? Because logic would dictate that, okay, we don't want to reveal all of this because it might damage the reputation of our institution. But on the other hand, they must think, or perhaps they don't think, well, if this all then subsequently comes out, it's going to be even more damaging to the reputation of our institution.
You know, what we always find is, you know, an allegation of sexual abuse for individuals, for families, for communities, for institutions, it's just such an explosion. You know, when an allegation is made, it causes such disruption, and it brings so many issues to the surface. You know, tremendous issues around obviously legal issues, personal issues, because people might have a relationship with the offender of different kinds. There's financial issues in terms of potential compensation or loss of revenue. And so there's such a burden to believing the allegation, and yet there's really no cost to the institution for silence. You know, all of the incentives for institutions and for bystanders, all of the incentives are orientated towards silence, not listening, not hearing, not doing anything, because to believe and accept the allegation and to act on it is really to invite, you know, a tremendous amount of difficulty and trouble. And that's really why so many survivors don't disclose, because they know that if they speak out, you know, that this bomb is going to go off. And it gives us a lot of insight to just, you know, what a burden that survivors often carry, you know, whether they're children or they're adults, they sort of carry this very heavy knowledge that speaking out is going to come with a lot of costs, not just to them, but more broadly.
I wonder, flipping that on its head, so to speak, looking at the individuals in the institution, whether there's this sense of living in denial once a revelation or disclosure has been made to them. They just don't want to confront, which perhaps they know deep down, subconsciously, is probably true.
I think that's absolutely the case. You know, for survivors out there, when they've made a complaint, you know, we often see families split. We see institutions split. Many people feel the impulse to identify with or to protect the alleged perpetrator. You know, it's not a predictable response to allegations of sexual abuse. They're often quite divisive. We should also bear in mind that it was only in the early 80s that there was strong community and scholarly consensus that child sexual abuse was fundamentally wrong, morally wrong, and also that it was probably harmful to the child. You know, prior to the early to mid-1980s, there was in the scholarly literature, but also in moral and religious discourse, a lot of ambivalence about who was at fault in relation to child sexual abuse. Was it the adult? But perhaps the child was also at fault. Yeah. Perhaps the child had acted in a way that invited the abuse. And there was also a lot of uncertainty about whether or not child abuse was particularly harmful. So when we look, for example, at historical allegations, you know, when institutions might have been made aware of allegations of abuse in the 60s or the 70s, they had many, many different rationalizations available to them to ignore the report or to blame the child.
That's interesting because it's in a religious context. I've heard many a time the survivor say, I reported the allegation to whoever in that religious organization, and I would be told, I need to pray. I need to pray for the abuser or the alleged abuser. So again, that feeds into what you're saying there about, well, it goes beyond ambivalence. It's actually sort of distorting so that the survivor is put into a position where they have to carry the responsibility of the disclosure. So that the person, the priest, the nun, or whoever it is telling them, you must now pray. You're not to condemn. You are to pray for the person that you say has done these things. And that is quite psychologically extremely powerful and, of course, potentially damaging as well, as we know from the many cases that we've seen. So it comes back to this distortion. What is it that makes people, when they receive a disclosure, distort what they've heard?
When we look, particularly in the religious context, you know, I think one of the real failures of religious institutions in the 20th century was to clearly articulate the difference, the categorical difference between an adult and a child. And in fact, this is, you know, this is a distortion that we see in pedophilia more generally and among sex offenders is a failure to recognize that children are, in a very fundamental way, children are different from adults. And I think this distortion was operating in many religious and also secular institutions, but particularly religious institutions where children were really seen as little adults or sort of substandard adults. And there was a strong focus on disciplining children and sort of forming or making children fit into an appropriate religious mold. Really a lack of a focus on sort of safeguarding and protecting children and recognizing their vulnerability. So that message to kids who have been abused, which was then that they needed to go and pray, they maybe needed to seek forgiveness, they needed to reflect on their own complicity. And we see this treatment of the child as a quasi-adult instead of really acknowledging and respecting the vulnerability of the child. And I do think it's fair to hold religious institutions to account for a really broad-based failure around safeguarding throughout most of the 20th century.
I think it's myself, from what I'm hearing and seeing, that this continues now in the 21st century in certain faiths. So you hear with certain faiths, particularly where the survivor is female, she will be saying, say in certain faiths, she would be considered as damaged goods as a result of the abuse. So in certain faiths, which are perhaps patriarchal in a way, the survivor is saying, well, I'm made to feel as though somehow I'm at fault because the net consequence is that I'm damaged goods, which may affect my prospects on when it comes to marriage. And so that has wider implications as regards my family. because they see me as someone that has been harmed, obviously, but also in a wider context of being harmed, but it's going to influence how they as a family are going to be viewed when it comes to marriage prospects.
100%. And this goes to the stigma of sexual abuse, that to be, in many contexts, to have been sexually abused is then stigmatized by a community or by an institution. And we see that stigma operating in all sorts of ways. But one of the things that that stigma does in an institution or a community is it sort of gives permission to the community or the institution for the cover-up, because the victim, in a sense, becomes less valued and less valuable. So as the institution is assessing what the pros and cons are, who are we going to support, you know, who we're going to swing our resources behind, you know, if the victim's been diminished in the eyes of their community, then that community or institution much less likely to pull behind them. And yeah, that's a real issue in moral, some of the moral and religious vocabularies around sexual abuse. Again, they have failed to appropriately attribute responsibility to the adult and to avoid any language of stain or damage in the advent of sexual abuse. Those discourses are not necessary. They are not theologically correct. And then I think there needs to be a lot of reflection in the context of religious institutions and communities about how that language of sin and moral decay is actively used by perpetrators against victims.
So in that kind of cultural setting where you've got this culture where a child or young person may make a disclosure and the family say, no, you've got to keep quiet about this because of the wider implications for that family and that community, we need to try and think about solutions to get that cultural shift, because effectively the family and the wider community are involved, either consciously or subconsciously, in covering up allegations of sexual abuse. And so one of the ideas is whether lawmakers should be considering compulsory auditing of religious bodies, so that, you know, if you've got a particular, all particular faiths, large, small, whatever, should be subjected to some kind of external auditing, so that you drive through a cultural shift, so that these religious communities, these cultures, actually have no choice but to start to change the way that they view these things. Any thoughts on that?
So certainly in Australia, we have arrangements whereby any child-focused or youth-serving organisation that receives government funding is annually audited for their adherence to child safety principles, and that audit is signed off at a very high level within the organisation. So I do think those sorts of measures are useful and appropriate. But when we turn our mind to primary prevention, so how do we prevent child sexual abuse before it occurs? You know, we need to engage faith leaders and community leaders in a dialogue that authentically changes norms and attitudes. And I don't think criminal law is the right way to do that. I think we need a comprehensive and holistic primary prevention model that engages with community attitudes, engages with issues in institutions, and works in a very constructive, strength-based way to promote change that's going to keep kids safe. And unfortunately, you know, primary prevention is an area that governments have criminally underinvested in when it comes to child sexual abuse. We just haven't seen wide-scale attempts in the United Kingdom or in Australia or in commensurate jurisdictions to actually reduce the overall prevalence of child sexual abuse. And I think that's the next step.
Yeah, and you and I are hopefully going to be producing a piece of work on this later on in the year. Generally speaking, I was doing some preparatory research for all of this, and it was quite interesting to read about how in some parts of the world and in some communities, it's seen as generally acceptable to abuse young people. There seems to be some kind of sort of societal, cultural acceptance that it was okay, believe it or not. So I think the challenge is quite immense, because it does seem as though at certain levels there's, it's sort of embedded that certain people are allowed to behave in a completely unacceptable way. And it also is of concerning that some young people seem to have been conditioned in a way that to be abused is just something that you have to go along with because that's the way it is. So I understand where you're coming from, Michael. It does seem as though it's not just a criminal law response. We actually need to get behind some pretty deep-seated issues and trends in order to have some real suggestions for prevention, because that, at the end of the day, is what it all has to be about, prevention, stopping it from happening in the first place.
I mean, ultimately, I think, you know, child sexual abuse is a major public health crisis, and we can address it as a public health issue in the same way that we might address obesity or diabetes or smoking. You know, the fact is that the governments have been reluctant to tackle this issue head on, to identify the prevailing myths and attitudes in the community, of which there are many, that justify and minimize child sexual abuse. You know, the simple fact that many people in the community have been taught to believe that children lie about child abuse, they've been taught to believe that false memories of child abuse are common, you know, all of these enabling environments for abuse. And until government agencies are willing to confront those myths head on and to promote positive change in social attitudes, then of course we're going to continue to see high rates of child abuse. We certainly can't arrest our way out of the problem. There's just too many offences.
Well, yeah, you know, it's shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted. And what I'm really interested in is trying to find ways of reducing the abuse in the first place, because that would save so much stress, trouble, misery, financial cost, damaged lives, you name it. I think that's what has to be the priority. Yes, as you say, you can't arrest your way out of this situation. You've got to get in there and stop it from happening in the first place. Anyway, so maybe the subject of another podcast one day. So, but we'll see about that. So thank you, Michael. Always great to talk to you. Thank you, listeners. And I hope you found this latest podcast of interest.
Thank you for listening to this episode of HJ Talks About Abuse. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or your favourite podcast player. If you'd like to speak to us about something you've heard today, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at aboutabuse@hjtalks.co.uk.